On January 22, 1943, a Halifax plane soared through the night sky over a snowy field in Saint-Laurent-en-Gâtine, France. The plane carried precious cargo, a lone Frenchman dressed in plain clothes, a parachute strapped to his back. The Frenchman was on a top-secret mission for a British intelligence service, an agency called the Special Operations Executive, or the SOE. As the plane blasted through the sky, the Frenchman checked his personal inventory, a stack of cash, diamonds, a pair of gold cufflinks given to him by a friend, an officer at the SOE. The man carried something else, too. Fake papers identifying him as Maurice Fabre. His real name was Henri Dericourt. Henri was no stranger to clandestine operations. He was a man with a hunger for adventure and a talent for deception. Henri checked his parachute, bracing himself. This jump wasn't just dangerous, it was illegal. He reached down and slid open a metal hatch in the belly of the cargo hold. And then, the British spy fell through the clouds, straight into Nazi-occupied France. This is Espionage, a Parcast original, where we explore the secret missions of the world's most incredible spies. Throughout this show, we'll explore real-world spy tactics required to impersonate, exploit, and infiltrate the most confidential places in the world. I'm your host, Carter. You can listen to all of Parcast's shows on your favorite podcast directory. New episodes come out every Friday. We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast, and Twitter at Parcast Network. This is our first episode on Henri Dericourt, the French Air Force test pilot turned British spy. It's important to note that the stories of Henri Dericourt are convoluted, shrouded in conspiracy theories, and hard to pin down. This week, we'll follow Henri as he works his way to the center of one of the most consequential clandestine operations in World War II. Next week, in part two, we'll explore the tragic conclusion of Henri's mission, a journey that left a trail of death, deceit, and destruction in its wake. The sound of the wind was deafening as Henri plummeted towards the earth. After about 30 seconds, he pulled the cord on his parachute. It was a so-called blind drop, a tactic the British implemented frequently during World War II. A blind drop wasn't a strategy so much as a necessity. In the depths of war, it was too risky to have someone radioing the plane or waiting for Henri on the ground. Because of that, neither Henri nor his pilot could be sure of their exact location or the altitude Henri dropped from. He could have deployed his parachute too late and soon found himself in enemy territory with two broken legs. Or he could have jumped out too early and found himself landing in the middle of a Nazi outpost. Whatever happened moving forward, Henri was completely on his own. He plummeted, wind rushing in his ears, followed by eerie silence. A few minutes later, his feet touched the ground in an empty field. As Henri released his parachute, he breathed a sigh of relief. But his night was far from over. According to former OSS Sergeant and CIA analyst Robert Kehoe, even those who survived a blind drop faced risks. Quote, if the drop was successful, the parachutist had to rely on his speed, skill, and knowledge of the area. Accurate information on ground conditions was not current. End quote. So Henri had to think on his feet and on the run. If he didn't find shelter and quickly, the frigid weather might overtake him. He had to get out of the snow. He ran as fast as he could toward a nearby train station that would take him to Paris, France. A Paris littered with Nazi soldiers and secret police, the Gestapo. by January 1943, Nazis had occupied France for almost 3 years. The war felt endless. The French, betrayed by their own Vichy government, were exhausted. The British plot to liberate France was long and complicated, so we'll zero in on Henri Dericourt's role in it as a new recruit for the Special Operations Executive. Now, the Special Operations Executive, or SOE, was a three-year-old espionage agency. It was founded by Hugh Dalton, a member of Winston Churchill's wartime coalition cabinet, and sanctioned by Prime Minister Churchill himself. Now, the SOE's goal was to aid the French resistance in retaking France through spying, sabotage, and spreading messages. Henri's mission was the latter. Once in Paris, he'd start work as an air controller, coordinating smuggling operations, whether that be smuggling secret messages or smuggling British spies. Henri would coordinate flights, locate secure landing strips, lay out flight paths, and transmit important communiques in and out of the war zone. Specifically, he'd be aiding a group of agents known as the Prosper Network. But it wasn't just about delivering mail and planning travel. Henri's work in the SOE was laying the groundwork for an impending Allied invasion. That was, assuming he even made it to Paris in the first place. Luckily, Henri knew the area. He'd grown up in a small hamlet northeast of Paris, but Henri's Paris was more that of Les Miserables than Marie Antoinette. He grew up poor, born in 1909 to a peasant laborer and a domestic servant. They could barely afford their three children, of which Henri was the youngest. As a child, Henri frequently accompanied his mother to her work on a wealthy Parisian estate. There, he caught a glimpse of the finer things life had to offer, things his parents could not. From very early on, Henri resolved that he would not be a laborer like his father or a servant like his mother. Henri would be rich. Henri would have a life. Henri would have adventure. When he left home at age 16, Henri crafted a new story about his life. Well, many stories, in fact. To bury the shame of his past, Henri cultivated a talent for telling lies. He would tell people he was the son of a wealthy and respected French family, that he studied math and science at the lycée, and he'd lied himself all the way into a job spying for the SOE. And while Henri was the only person privy to his personal history and motivations, he wasn't the only person involved in this mission. As soon as he reached Paris on January 24th, 1943, he knocked on the door of Julien Aynaire. Julien, or Juju, as Henri called her, lived in a small flat in the Place des Ternes in Paris, France. She was a screenwriter who'd spent time living abroad, once widowed, once divorced. But one man she'd kept in her life was Henri Dericourt. They'd been on-again, off-again lovers for years, both before and after his marriage, and before and after her new relationship with a man named Charles Bénard. Even still, she was shocked to see Henri at the door. Henri had disappeared 6 months ago, and Juju had begun to wonder if she'd ever see him again. And yet, there he was, standing in the doorway, acting like no time had passed at all. She invited him in and asked the usual questions: where have you been? Why are you here? And most importantly, what do you want? Henri's answer was suspect. I'm working for the British. Well, Juju knew Henri had a complicated relationship with the truth, and she knew better than to take him at his word, but she didn't press him for information. Henri asked Juju if she would help him and his wife find a place in the city, and Juju agreed. Henri thanked her with a wad of cash, and just like that, he was gone again. Headed for the rail station to catch a train to Marseille, Henri was off to see an old friend, a fellow named Remy Clément. Around the same time that Henri knocked on Juju's door in Paris in January 1943, his old friend Remy sat at his desk in Marseille, France. When he picked up the phone, Remy was surprised to hear a familiar voice on the other end of the line. It was Henri's wife, Jeannot. She told Remy to come by her flat after work. It was important. Remy instantly knew. Henri was back. That night, Henri and Remy sat down in Henri's tiny flat at 50 Rue Curiole in Marseille. The two had a familiar rapport. They were both in their 30s and both French pilots who met flying missions for French intelligence. Remy was an Air France pilot, and Henri was assigned to his squadron. Now, these were the type of friends who could be apart for months on end and pick right back up where they left off. But Henri didn't invite Remy over to reminisce about the old days. After sharing a drink, Henri got down to business. He asked Remy to move to Paris and help him run a secret operation for the Brits. Henri laid out the details of his mission. Secret agents were to be flown in and out of France late at night. The SOE needed a team to organize flights and flight paths, secure landing strips, and transport secure communiques in and out of the war zone. Well, Remy had a decent job and a decent paycheck, but it was going nowhere. He was bored out of his mind. Besides, Remy didn't belong behind a desk. He belonged in the air. But Remy also must have known the dangers involved. The Gestapo had a penchant for executing spies, and Remy didn't want to put his family in harm's way. Henri left the ball in Remy's court. He and Jeannot would be leaving for Paris the next morning. Remy would have till then to decide. By morning, Remy had decided. He was in. He saw Henri and Jeannot off at the train station. The couple headed for Paris, right into the belly of the Nazis' operations in France. Well, in the 1940s, the Nazis had grand designs for France in their mission for a new world order in Europe. Hitler wanted France to be the epicenter of leisure for the German overlords of the future. The Nazis wanted to show the world that French and German culture were harmonious and complementary. So, despite occupation, the white Gentile French population could move about France, taking trains to and from Paris, relatively unencumbered. British intelligence used this to their advantage, and so did Henri Dericourt. Once back in Paris, Henri and his wife, Jeannot, moved in with Juju, Henri's on-again-off-again lover, and her boyfriend, Charles. It must have been a sticky situation. Henri couldn't have been comfortable sharing a space with Charles. Jeannot knew about Henri and Juju's past, and Juju knew she knew. But everyone was polite and respectful for the moment. Henri and Juju quickly began work for the SOE. They'd begin by making contact with a subset of French-based SOE agents known as the Prosper Network and helping them with their operations. Henri was still waiting for Prosper to contact him, but in the meantime, he was getting his own team in place. Henri asked Juju if she would be willing to courier important intel for Prosper and to help him find safe houses for SOE agents in Paris. Even though Juju had doubts about his truthfulness, she promised Henri he could count on her. But Juju was right to be suspicious, because Henri had a secret. A secret he didn't tell the SOE. A secret he kept from Juju, Remy, and even his wife. Henri's real mission in France was not about the SOE or transporting spies in and out of France. That was just a cover for his true purpose. A few days after Henri's arrival in Paris in January 1943, he made a secret phone call from a payphone. The man on the other end of the line gave him his orders. Walk to the Bois de Boulogne, a large public park in Paris, and await further instructions. Henri walked to the park and waited. Eventually, a black Citroën automobile pulled to a stop in front of him. As the door opened, Henri looked inside to find the man he had called earlier that night sitting in the back seat. Karl Bummelberg, the head of the Gestapo in Nazi-occupied France. Coming up, we'll delve into Henri Dericourt's complicated relationship with the Third Reich. Now, back to the story. SS Major Karl Bummelberg was sent to Paris after graduating from the SS Leadership Academy in 1938. It was there that he first met a pilot named Henri Dericourt. This friendship began in the summer of 1938 when a mutual friend introduced them. The friendship continued for the next 5 years. And now, in January 1943, the Nazi official and the British spy sat together in a black Citroën, winding their way through the streets of Paris. Henri told Bummelberg how he'd escaped France on the Pat Line, a British underground railroad during the war, and made his way to an MI6 station in Gibraltar. How he'd been interrogated, cleared, and recruited to the SOE to help coordinate the secret trafficking of British agents in and out of France. Henri painted a picture of the Britain that had recruited him, a divided nation on the brink of collapse, overrun with communists and socialists. Henri despised it. He wanted to work for a government that rewarded hard work, a government like the Third Reich. He wanted to be a double agent. CIA analyst F.M. Begum wrote that there are three types of double agents. The walk-in, who essentially shows up in enemy territory and offers to turn traitor for them. Then there's the agent detected and doubled, who, upon being caught by the enemy, agrees to switch sides. And finally, the provocation agent, who pretends to be a walk-in, but is actually there on orders from their own government. As far as Bummelberg could tell, Henri was what Begum would call a walk-in, a man who showed up and offered to turn traitor of his own accord. Intrigued, Bummelberg asked Henri what he would require. Henri explained that his most immediate problem was finding a place to live. He and his wife couldn't keep living with his ex-lover and her boyfriend. Bummelberg was more than happy to help. On January 27th, 1943, Henri and his wife Jeannot packed their things, left Juju's flat, and moved across town to the Hotel Bristol, one of the most exclusive hotels in Paris, a hotel controlled and operated by the Nazis. At the reception desk, Henri presented a letter from Bummelberg to the concierge. This was a golden ticket. Henri and his wife were given a room without question. Moving into the Bristol was a risky move for Henri. Paris was crawling with SOE agents. If they discovered Henri in a Nazi hotel, his cover would be blown. But for Henri, apparently, it was a risk worth taking. Over the next 3 weeks, Juju and Henri would occasionally meet at a nearby cafe to talk about the mission. As far as Juju knew, Henri was working for the SOE and had moved into a temporary hotel to spare her and her boyfriend the discomfort of housing him and his wife. Henri conveniently neglected to mention the specific hotel he was staying at. Juju wanted to know when the agents of the Prosper Network would make contact. Soon, Henri told her. It was only a matter of time. In mid-February 1943, Juju gave Henri some good news. There was a small two-bedroom apartment for sale near the Avenue Foch. It needed some work, but it was Henri's if he wanted it. Henri leaped at the opportunity. A few weeks later, Remy Clément and his family finally arrived in Paris, having taken a few weeks to get their affairs in order. Henri's team, which he codenamed the Farrier Network, was now fully assembled. It was only a matter of time before Prosper agents made contact and put the Farrier Network to work. And in late February, Prosper agents made their first contact with Henri. Within weeks, Farrier had their first mission. On March 17th, 1943, four men boarded a train at Gare d'Orsay railway station in France. Henri waited on the train and watched as the men sat apart from each other, keeping their distance, pretending to be perfect strangers. The men shared silent and subtle nods of recognition as the train pulled out of the station, bound for Poitiers, France. No words needed to be exchanged between them, because all four men, all secret agents for the SOE, already knew the plan, and they trusted that with Henri, they were in capable hands. And once the train arrived in Poitiers, the agents went their separate ways. They waited till nightfall, long after the German enforced curfew. The streets were virtually empty, save for Nazi soldiers. The men snuck through the streets and met at a prearranged rendezvous, where Henri waited with bicycles. Holding a lamp, Henri took the lead and led the bicycle convoy to a secret airfield. In France in 1943, there were as many as 80 secret airfields. This SOE field was codenamed B-19. The Farrier Network had been preparing for this night for weeks, surveying airfields, lining up safe houses, and planning travel routes. This was Operation Trainer. Operation Trainer was a simple but dangerous mission, smuggling several British agents back to London. As Hugh Verity, an RAF pilot who flew similar operations, said, quote, "They went in by parachute, but they couldn't come out by parachute." The agents escaped by plane, meeting up and taking off from secret airfields, which were commonly marked with cultivated patches of lavender and potato plants. Arriving at the airfield, Henri concealed his passengers in a cluster of trees and ran off to lay a path of turned-off flashlights on the ground. Just after midnight, a plane engine rumbled in the distance. Henri gave his compatriots their instructions. On his command, they would make a break for the flashlights and turn them on one by one. This would light up the outline of the airfield, showing the pilot where to safely land. While the passengers did their part, Henri used his flashlight to send a signal to the plane in Morse code. If the Lysander's pilot responded with the same code, the mission was a go. If not, Henri would abort. Henri flashed the signal, and the Lysander flashed it back. It was game on. At midnight, the first Lysander landed. Henri quickly ushered some of the spies onto the plane and sent them on their way. An hour later, the second Lysander landed safely, and the remaining spies boarded. The plane took off and disappeared into the night sky. Everything was done with the utmost speed and discretion. Pilot Hugh Verity said that these operations were so secretive, he often had no idea who he was flying out of France and into Britain. Operation Trainer went off without a hitch, and the Nazis were none the wiser, at least not yet. A few days later, in mid-March 1943, Henri secretly met with Bummelberg, his Gestapo contact. Henri gave him the full rundown, names and descriptions of the agents involved with the most recent SOE operation. Bummelberg was interested in Operation Trainer, but he was more interested in the Prosper Network. Bummelberg asked Henri what he knew about Prosper. Henri told Bummelberg Prosper's primary directive was supporting an impending invasion of France by the Allied forces. The Allies were getting ready to strike, and Prosper was laying the groundwork. For Bummelberg, this was extremely valuable information. For Henri, it helped improve his value to the Third Reich and solidified his arrangement with Bummelberg. It didn't hurt that he was well compensated for his work. Henri was being paid by British intelligence to organize SOE missions in collaboration with Prosper, but the Nazis, in exchange for information on the nature of these operations, were also paying him. Now, the question is, as a native Frenchman, friend of Bummelberg, and willing recruit to the SOE, where did Henri's loyalty truly lie? Ultimately, relationships between men like Bummelberg and Dericourt came down to one thing: trust. And in the spring of 1943, Karl Bummelberg was starting to trust Henri Dericourt. He believed the man loyal to the Third Reich. But Bummelberg would have been wise to be more suspicious of Henri Dericourt. Henri had lied to the SOE about his past. He had withheld the truth about his arrangement with Bummelberg from his friends, his wife, and the agents of the Prosper Network. And he was lying about something else, too. The truth was, Henri Dericourt was not a double agent. He was not working for the SOE, or the Nazis for that matter. Henri Dericourt was a triple agent. He was really working for another British secret intelligence service, commonly known as MI6. And by March 1943, Bummelberg had bought Henri Dericourt's deception hook, line, and sinker. Coming up, we'll explore Henri Dericourt's relationship with another intelligence agency, MI6. And now, back to the story. Shortly after his meeting with SS Major Karl Bummelberg in March 1943, Triple Agent Henri Dericourt went home to his new flat, sat down at his desk, took out his pen and paper, and made detailed notes of their conversation. Through a series of intermediaries, these notes made their way out of France, across the Channel, and onto the desk of the second in command at MI6, a circumspect 67-year-old master spy by the name of Claude Dancy. Claude Dancy was a cautious man who rarely wrote down a word. He was rumored to be both a closeted gay man and a Freemason, but neither stopped him from climbing the ranks of intelligence. He had a reputation for being charming, cunning, and dangerous. His relationship with Henri Dericourt began back in August of 1942, 5 months before Henri blind-dropped into Nazi-occupied France. At that time, Dancy oversaw the Patline, a de facto underground railroad for Europeans hoping to escape the war zone into Great Britain. One of their stations was in Gibraltar. In August 1942, Dancy received a message from an agent on the ground there. It read, "Request priority on two Frenchmen, Dericourt and Dulay." Dancy was surprised and intrigued to find a pair of Frenchmen on his escape line. He quickly sent a reply. "Who are Dericourt and Dulay?" Gibraltar's response, "Air France pilots." Henri was lying to him. He was not, in fact, an Air France pilot who flew secret missions for the French in Syria, as he and Dulay told agents in Gibraltar. He said that to appear more valuable to the British. Dancy, naturally, ordered MI6 agents to verify Henri's story. Not long after, word reached Dancy that no one in MI6 had, quote, any recollection whatsoever of having met Henri Dericourt at any time, and certainly not in Syria, end quote. In reply, Dancy gave the agents at MI6 Gibraltar his final answer. No priority, Dericourt and Dulay. But strangely, Dericourt and Dulay were not cut loose, nor sent back to France. they were passed on to another British intelligence agency, MI5. On September 7, 1942, MI6 sent Henri and Dulay by boat from Gibraltar to Greenock near Glasgow, Scotland. Once they hit land, the two Frenchmen were immediately seized and separated from the rest of the passengers on board. While being held in Greenock, Henri began to fear that he was about to be locked up. So he offered up another piece of information. Henri had contacts with German intelligence. It's hard to imagine that this explosive piece of information was not immediately relayed to Claude Dancy, but it's impossible to know for sure. Regardless, from Greenock, Henri and Dulay were put on a train and sent to the Royal Patriotic School southwest of London and delivered into the hands of MI5 agents. There, Henri and Dulay were separated and interrogated. If Henri was a German infiltrator, MI5 was hell-bent on finding out. After questioning Henri, multiple MI5 agents expressed reservations about Henri's trustworthiness. MI5 refused to sign off on keeping Dericourt in the country. Well, under normal circumstances, this would have been the end of the line. But instead, 4 days later, on September 11, 1942, Henri and Dulay were sent to Victoria, where they were both checked into the same hotel. Not long after they arrived, Dulay noticed something strange. His friend Henri Dericourt was missing. The public record on the next few months is vague at best. Many historians believe that in September of 1942, Dancy recruited Henri for his own purposes, to work as an agent in MI6. This much is certain. In September 1942, Henri disappeared out of thin air. A couple months later, in late November, Henri resurfaced, this time as a pilot and ground controller for the Special Operations Executive. 1 month later, in December, Henri was given an honorary commission in the British Royal Air Force. 1 month after that, on January 22, 1943, Henri climbed on board a Halifax plane and blind dropped into Nazi-occupied France. Once there, he maintained regular communication with Claude Dancy. But virtually no one was aware of this, especially not Bummelberg or the SOE. Dericourt and Dancy communicated in two ways. The first was through a bank teller at a branch of the Credit Lyonnais in the Rue de Caumartin. The second was through a barman at the Bar Lorraine in the Place de Terne, not far from Juju's apartment. Henri kept Dancy up to date about his meetings with Bummelberg, and perhaps more importantly, he told Dancy what Bummelberg wanted to know: the names and identities of the SOE agents in France. Henri must have known, and Claude Dancy absolutely knew, that his arrangement with the Nazis was putting the lives of hundreds of British agents at risk. So why did Dancy allow it? Well, to start, he disliked the SOE. Special Operations Executive was an entirely separate agency from MI6, and suffice it to say, the two spy organizations did not get along. In addition to the inevitable competition and resentment between two espionage agencies supporting the same country, Dancy actually worried the SOE had been compromised by Nazis before Henri Dericourt began sharing their secrets with Karl Bummelberg. As far as the SOE was concerned, SOE agents in France were the tip of the spear for an impending Allied invasion, and Henri Dericourt was incredibly valuable to that mission. Or, perhaps, that's precisely what Claude Dancy wanted the Nazis to believe. You see, the British government had a problem, and in Henri Dericourt, Claude Dancy believed he had found a potential solution. In early 1943, The Allied leaders, mainly British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Russian leader Joseph Stalin, had agreed that Hitler needed to be destroyed before the year was out. Invading France and driving out the Germans was priority number one. However, the British just weren't ready for an invasion of that magnitude. They didn't have the equipment, and they didn't have the manpower. But if they didn't go through with something, they'd fracture an already tenuous relationship with Russia. So in the spring of 1943, Winston Churchill authorized Operation Cockade. The goal of Cockade was to use disinformation to convince the Germans that the Allied forces were dead set on invading France in 1943. Feeding the Germans this deliberate lie would conceal the real operation, the Normandy invasion, also known as D-Day, that was now set to occur in 1944. The use of disinformation dates all the way back to the Roman Empire, and it's still often employed today. According to former CIA analyst Preston Golson and Matthew F. Ferraro, modern spies train themselves to fight disinformation. They've written, quote, "Intelligence officers are taught tradecraft, structured analytic techniques designed to challenge, refine, and challenge again, essentially learning how to tear down their own assumptions and spot the psychological tricks humans are prone to fall for." However, Ferraro and Golson admit that even spies who are fully aware of disinformation tactics can be deceived. In Operation Cockade, Henri Dericourt would establish trust with Bummelberg by giving him true intelligence concerning SOE operations. Then, he would slowly begin to feed Bummelberg lies. And, given Bummelberg's position as head of the Gestapo in France, those lies would quickly move up the chain to the Führer himself. The Nazis, assuming their intelligence source was still good, would prepare for an invasion that wasn't coming. By the time the real invasion came around, they'd be taken by complete surprise. Well, no doubt this was a plot that could blow up in Dancy's face, but it was a strategic risk he was more than willing to take. And it would be Henri Dericourt who would find himself in harm's way. But in the meantime, Henri continued to work for the SOE, behaving as if it was his sole loyalty. In April of 1943, 3 months after Henri parachuted into France, Henri and Juju climbed into the car of an SOE operative named Francis Suttle. Now, Suttle was half British, half French, and a former officer in the British Army. Codenamed Prosper, Suttle was head of the Prosper Network. Suttle commanded the respect of his agents, and that commanded the respect of Henri Dericourt. In Suttle's eyes, Henri Dericourt, codenamed Gilbert, was integral to his operation. Henri had done good work so far, and it was time for Henri to meet the rest of the team. Suttle drove Henri and Juju out of Paris to an SOE safe house in Versailles, just southeast of Paris. At the safe house in Versailles, Henri and Juju met the bulk of Prosper's agents. At the meeting, Suttle laid out the agenda. Lysander missions were going to pick up in the coming weeks and months. Back in London, an ever-growing stream of British agents were lining up to get to France. Henri and his people needed to be ready to receive them. Henri and Juju assured Prosper that the Ferrier Group was good to go. By April 1943, Prosper's SOE activities were in full swing. Henri and the rest of the Ferrier Group were working around the clock, making preparations and smuggling agents into the country. But one night, as they pored over maps and worked on scoping out potential airfields, Remy noticed something strange in Henri's demeanor. Henri was normally a self-assured man with infectious confidence, but that night he seemed uneven and unsure, afraid even. When Remy asked him what was wrong, Henri stopped what he was doing and replied, "I need help." Henri told Remy that the job was too much for him. He didn't know if he could keep going on his own. He looked exhausted, his face marred with puffy bags under his red, weary eyes. When Remy asked Henri what he could do to help, Henri said he wanted Remy to be on the ground with him for the actual operations. Remy would need Henri to show him the ropes, but he happily agreed. But there was something Henri didn't tell Remy, perhaps the very thing that had been keeping him up at night. Henri's triple agent role was beginning to take its toll. Henri had gotten to know the agents of the Prosper Network, men like Francis Suttle, and he was beginning to like and respect them. It's one thing to betray an enemy. It's another to betray a friend. And giving Carl Bummelberg information was most certainly putting his new friends in harm's way. And Bummelberg continued asking for more, even sending Henri keys to a Nazi safe house so they could meet there. On the surface, the Parisian flat was a logical meeting place. It offered privacy and security. But it was also the type of place that people never came back from. The type of remote location where Gestapo soldiers gagged and bagged traitors before sending them off to a concentration camp. Henri knew he had to show up. He was in too deep to get out now. To stay useful, and therefore alive, Henri needed to continually earn Carl Bummelberg's trust. In the world of espionage, there's one surefire way to gain someone's trust. Give them valuable, verifiable information. According to former analyst F.M. Begum, trust from the adversary is one of the most important things the CIA looks for in a double agent. But there's something of an unspoken golden rule when it comes to counterintelligence. Don't give away too much. For Henri, the name of the game was giving Bummelberg just enough to entice his interest in hypothetical information that might be coming down the pike. But in early April 1943, Bummelberg was beginning to ask for a lot. He wanted the date and location of each Lysander operation in advance so that his men could follow the British agents. This was a problem for Henri. If any of the British SOE agents were arrested, it could give away the game. Not to mention their lives would be in danger. And if the SOE found out Henri was the mole, his life would be in danger too. So Henri brokered a deal with Bummelberg. If Henri gave Bummelberg the info he wanted, Bummelberg would promise not to arrest a single SOE agent. The men shook on it. Not long after, Henri received word from SOE. The bosses wanted Henri to take a break and return to London. Henri wasn't thrilled about the prospect of leaving his friends and family, but he didn't have a choice. So he called a meeting with Bummelberg to tell him the news. Needless to say, Bummelberg was frustrated. Henri was his most valuable asset, and the thought of losing him, even for a couple weeks, was troubling. And Bummelberg had another concern. How could he be sure Henri would come back at all? Henri looked him in the eyes and told Bummelberg the truth. Jeannot was staying in Paris, and he would never abandon his wife. Bummelberg was assured, at least for the moment. On Thursday, April 22nd, Henri packed his bags, headed to the train station, and bought a ticket for Le Mans, where a plane would take him back to Britain. While he waited for the train to arrive, a message arrived by courier. As he opened the note and read the words, his heart must have skipped a beat. The message said that earlier that night, two elderly sisters were arrested by German intelligence officers. One of the women was directly connected to the Prosper Network, an associate of Francis Suttle. Henri ran to the nearest phone and dialed Bummelberg. After several tries, he finally picked up. Panicked, Henri demanded to know just what in the hell was going on. Bummelberg did his best to calm Henri down. He had nothing to do with her arrest. Abwehr, a separate German intelligence agency, was to blame, not the Gestapo. Henri wasn't blown. The Prosper agents were safe. There would be no more arrests. Everything would be fine. As Henri hung up the phone, the last thing he wanted to do was get on that train. But orders were orders. Henri had to wonder, what if Bummelberg was lying? What if Remy and his friends in the Prosper network were about to be rounded up and sent to the firing squad? What if he was blown? What if the bosses back at SOE had found him out? As the train roared out of the station, Henri must have been frightened. Even if Bummelberg was telling the truth, he couldn't keep up this work in Paris. He had to get out. He had to get to the one person who would help him, Claude Dancy. But Henri would soon find out that Claude Dancy was every bit as dangerous as Carl Bummelberg. The path he was on would lead to betrayal, death, and destruction. The train had left the station, and there was no turning back. Next week in part two, we'll follow Henri Dericourt's mission to its bloody conclusion. For more information on Henri Dericourt, amongst the many sources we used, we found All the King's Men by Robert Marshall extremely helpful to our research. Thank you for listening to Espionage. We'll be back Friday with a new episode. You can find more episodes of Espionage, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll be back next week with another deep dive into the world of clandestine operation. Espionage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Paul Liebeskind. Additional production assistance by Carly Madden and Maggie Admire. Espionage is written by Stephen Walters. I'm Carter Roy.